Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study.
It's a great pleasure for me to have with me in the studio today Fernand N. Toutail, who is Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame in the USA. He's here in Malta at the invitation of the American Ambassador, Ambassador Kimmich. The organization of a lecture here has been made through the US Embassy and through our Faculty of Laws, in particular the Department of Criminal Law. Just a few words about Professor Toutail, and I gather that he's known to his friends as Tex.
I am indeed.
He is a graduate of Assumption College and Notre Dame, where he served as the articles editor for the Law Review, the Notre Dame Lawyer. Called to the bar in 1965, Professor Toutail practiced law in the honors program of the U.S. Department of Justice and taught law at the Catholic University of America before returning to Notre Dame as a member of faculty in 71. He became a full professor in 76, and during his tenure at Notre Dame he has served in a number of administrative positions. He co-directed the London programme in 1991 and taught on the programme in 94 and 96, and I gather is still involved in it today. He's also held a position of senior visiting lecturer at the University of Aberdeen and scholar in residence at the University of Queensland during the summers of 95 and 96. Professor Toutail's teaching and scholarship concentrate on two main areas. He teaches criminal law to first-year students and has written extensively in that area. He also teaches and writes in the law on the law of education. He served as faculty editor of the Journal of College and University Law and has been a member of that publication's editorial board for many years. Professor Toutail has served on countless university and law school committees, including the Academic Council, of which he was a member for about a quarter of a century. In 2001, the university's Alumni Association conferred on him its Armstrong Award, bestowed annually on a graduate who has provided outstanding service as an employee. Professor Toutail has earned two presidential awards at Notre Dame. He's also garnered the university's Faculty Award in 2004, and his alma mater, Assumption College, presented him with an Outstanding Achievement Award in 2007. He's author of several books, innumerable papers, articles and chapters in books on subjects ranging from the prediction of criminal violence to juvenile delinquency and the burden of proof in criminal cases. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
At home, I'm surrounded, I might say, by lawyers. And although I've probably taken on a few legal concepts through by osmosis, it's not really my area of study. But I do look forward to hearing something about your experience as a lecturer in law. I'm sure that there's plenty of things which are of common interest to our own listeners on this program. As we're talking in a university context, perhaps you could tell me a little bit about how you go about introducing your subject, criminal law, to your first year students. I think it must be quite daunting.
It is more exciting than it is daunting, because in law school, the year you want to teach is at the first year level, because that is when they are most malleable, if you will. I don't mean that in a negative way, but they're most anxious to get it. They're most interested. You can form them, I think, in a special way that you can't when they're third year students and jaded. They come into criminal law with a lot of preconceptions, with a lot of interest, because they've watched a lot of stuff on television and in the movies. alas, it's somewhat of an awakening when they find out that criminal law, the course I teach, isn't just watching movies and watching television shows, that there's stuff that's difficult to learn and concepts that are difficult. But it's wonderful to be an agent in opening their eyes to new dimensions of law, to see how most important issues have two sides, else they wouldn't be important issues. I teach with a casebook that is largely problem-oriented. And so it asks them to use their creativity and to recognize, especially, this is the most difficult thing with first-year law students, that law is not the sort of thing that is just like learning a poem where you can now say, I know it. Law always has new and interesting questions, and this quest for certainty is an imaginary quest because you never get to where things are certain, what you're doing, exploring new things. The certain things aren't interesting to deal with for the most part. So I always tell them that certainty is inversely proportional to enlightenment. The example I use is that when I hear somebody cough, I say, well, they have a cold. But a doctor might say, well, no, I've got to know more. I've got to know whether the person's had a fever or whether the pupils are dilated and so forth. The doctor is less certain than I am, but knows more. And that's what's fun to see develop in our first-year students.
Yes, in fact, I think that what I have seen over the years as far as legal training is concerned is that even if somebody doesn't end up actually being a lawyer or working as a lawyer, the training that they get as lawyers, that legal training, that ability to analyze and to make a judgment about something that goes beyond just the obvious.
That is absolutely right. And one of the strong reasons to go to law school is precisely its flexibility. It's wonderful to be a philosopher. It's wonderful to have a PhD in history. But if you get to the end of that program, there are not that many options left to you beyond the academic. Whereas if you look around the United States, at least, and I'm guessing much of the world, the people who are doing interesting things in all kinds of fields, leading corporations, being in legislatures, and so forth, have been legally trained even though they're not practicing law. It is a wonderful place to get a very liberal education, even as you get a professional one. It's often said that the law school, unlike most departments on a campus, looks inward to the campus academically, but also looks outward to the community in terms of training for a profession. So it's a happy combination of those two things, and I think is a reason that draws many students to law school, and it drew me to law school originally.
In fact, people here sometimes complain because we have now, my husband's day, they were 20 on the course, and now they're 80 or 100. And people say, oh, gosh, we can't afford to have all these lawyers, or what are they all doing, what for? But in actual fact, what you're creating is a body of people out there working at managerial level, at doing other things, even if they're not lawyers, who have that wonderful training.
Absolutely.
So I think it can only be an asset to the country.
And let me add to that, that when you hear complaints about there are too many lawyers, as we hear it in the United States, and I gather from what you've said, you hear it here, it's important to remember two things at least. One is that in the United States, at least, there aren't too many lawyers. There may be a maldistribution, but we have a lot of people in the United States whose legal needs are not being met, and especially people who are poor. Unfortunately, we do not publicly fund the legal aid for that enough. Our universities are not in a good position to have their clinics deal with everything that comes in. Our own legal aid clinic gets a lot of very compelling cases from people who are suffering from landlord treatment or from spousal abuse, etc. And there's not enough legal help around. The other thing to remember is that sometimes they will say, well, the U.S. has so many more lawyers than, say, another country does. But it's very important to look at how many people are involved in the enterprise, not what label you put on them. In some countries, people are doing things that our lawyers are doing. They're professionals. They're just not called lawyers. So there's no substantive difference in how much time is being allocated to any particular thing.
What are those concepts that these new first-year students find most difficulty grasping in the initial stages? Because we've said that the mindset has to sort of turn.
That is, for a criminal law teacher, that is a really Great question, and pretty easy in terms of the areas. Very early on in the course, we're looking at the fact that most crimes involve an act of the body coupled with some intent of the mind that may or may not require a result. And so when we deal with this thing called mens rea, M-E-N-S-R-E-A, this mens rea, this mental element, it's a very difficult concept to grasp because statutes talk about variously willfully, maliciously, with premeditation, and so forth, and trying to grasp what mens rea means. If I say that anyone who unlawfully possesses an unregistered firearm commits a crime, do they have to know that it's unregistered? Do they have to know it's a firearm? Do they know that it's, have to know it's unlawful? Enough if they're reckless about that. All of these issues just taunt them, and they find both very provocative and also very elusive. The other one, and I won't go into it, is the issue of legal impossibility. If I try to pick somebody's pocket and there's no wallet there, is there an attempted crime, since theoretically at least there was no crime that could have been committed, but that I won't go into here.
The one that the general public often finds very difficulty in coping with, the idea that regardless of whether you are a murderer, you still deserve to have a defense.
Well, let's just parse that sentence a bit. Regardless of whether you are a murderer, well, of course, you are not legally a murderer until you have had that defense. It's interesting that nobody worries about doctors taking care of people who are bad, and yet sometimes worry about people who are bad, or at least allegedly bad, having legal representation. The only thing that makes us confident enough to be able to punish people is precisely because we gave them somebody to represent their side of the case. Without that, we would not have the confidence. And after all, if I'm charged with a federal crime in the United States, the prosecution has thousands of FBI agents, it has experts, it has lawyers, it has everything going for it in trying to convict me. All the system does is give me, presumably one or maybe two people, to represent my side of the case. And it may turn out, of course, that I am not a murderer, and it's not, of course, my job as defense lawyer to make that judgment with regard to the defendant. That's the juror's job.
Law schools in general, and you've obviously been lecturing for some years, have they been able to cope with the changing attitudes? Should they be coping with attitudes, or should they simply be coping with the changes in the law? How have you found those changes affecting law schools?
Well, obviously, to begin with, the changes in the law are very difficult to deal with because so many areas of law are either new now or at least have new dimensions to them. I have a colleague who teaches the law of all this new communication stuff, the iPads and so forth. Well, both the context, the technological context, and the law itself are racing to conclusions. What is libel in the context of twittering and all that tweeting and all that stuff? I don't understand. So that's difficult enough. There's no question that that our students' outlooks have changed. I mean, when I first started teaching, I was pretty much their age, and now I'm pretty much their grandparents' age, and that creates some generational gap in terms of what we can talk about in class, for example. I mean, the allusions I can make to newsworthy events to them sometimes is ancient history, if they've heard of it at all. And I think there is a greater sense of entitlement, for better or for worse, among students now. I think universities, I'm only speaking for the United States now, I can't speak for other areas, I think American universities have catered to that by trying to sell students on coming to their place rather than some other place, which has fostered, I think, a sense of consumerism among our students. And therefore, since I'm paying the tuition, I am entitled to have this, this, and this. I think there's much less of the relationship between teacher and student that would have been around 30 or 40 years ago when I first started teaching. That said, our students are immensely bright, and the cross-section of our students at Notre Dame today really are much brighter, much more able than the class that I was in 40 years ago. I think the top was strong, but now I think that the entire class is much stronger than it was.
Our students tend to shy away a bit from litigation, court work.
Possibly because they don't have advocacy skills, or at least there hasn't been in the past, although I know there is a movement now in the faculty to develop advocacy skills and offer certain credits. But they are often a bit frightened. It is daunting to stand up in front of a judge or a magistrate and plead your case for your client. Do your students have that difficulty, or do you think that culturally they're more ready for litigation?
Well, I think there's no question that litigation especially is something that practice makes perfect in, and law schools are not well adapted to do that sort of thing, largely for economic reasons. If you compare law to medicine, again in the United States, in medicine, in my later years of education, there'll be a doctor that I'll follow around, five or six of us will follow around and get very clinically oriented with. And the number of students we have in law school, we can't do that. We can't assign 50 students to a lawyer to sit in the lawyer's office all day and see what goes on. So it's much more difficult to get the practice done, the practice learning done during law school itself. But we've come a long way. We do have intensive trial advocacy courses. We have courses in taking of depositions. We have complex civil litigation courses, complex criminal litigation courses. We have federal criminal law, all of which are aimed at making the student better once the student hits the ground in practice. But it still remains difficult because the law schools aren't tremendously adapted to doing that or well suited to do it, given the numbers of students we have.
I know that you've been involved in the Notre Dame London program for some years. Why does Notre Dame feel the need to have a London program at all? And what are the benefits of it?
Well, one benefit that Notre Dame wasn't thinking of is that it allowed my wife and me to travel considerably in our lives, but that probably wasn't their primary goal. The program began in 1968 when we started it in conjunction with a London law school, the University of London, as I recall. We would send students to be educated with their law students. One of the difficulties that developed was that since law in the United States is a postgraduate study, that there was a tremendous disparity in age and outlook and emotional development between our students and theirs because of the age difference. And therefore, shortly thereafter, we developed our own program. And as time passed, it got more and more elaborate. We now have a very wonderful building just off Trafalgar Square, where the university does not only its law work, but also its other disciplines as well. With regard to the law school, the idea centered upon our history. So much in the United States, legally speaking, comes to us from an Anglo origin. And to have our students in a different country, especially that country that gave rise to so much of our law and so much of our history, we thought was critically important. And all of our students are there for a full year. We don't allow a one semester because we did not want it to be a tourist situation. I mean, obviously they will travel, but if they're there for a full year, the pressure to get Prague and Vienna and Rome and Paris all in is a little bit more dissipated. And it allows them to get into the stories of a European country, of seeing that, what happens is, as you know, it so broadens you to be in a different country, to see that there are things, yes, you do very well, things that other people do extremely well, and to get you more accustomed to a global approach. And as we see now, law is getting more and more global. My wife and I were walking down a street in Budapest once, and there was a big sign. There was an American law firm. You'd have sworn you were in Chicago. That's what's happened to law, as to so many other things. And so our students have got to get out of the idea that they're just bounded by the east and west coast of the United States.
Yes, of course. In fact, all the courses in American universities, I think they're insisting nowadays on study abroad.
Absolutely.
Time, and it can only do the students good. Our own students are clamoring now to go on Erasmus tours. This is just within the mm-hmm. within Europe, or Erasmus Mundus, which also includes other worldwide
Wonderful.
Universities. And the person who deals with them in the international office tells me that it is amazing how she talks to one student before they go and then talks to them when they come back. And the difference is tangible.
That's incredibly
the improvement,
important.
Really. Yes. The whole attitude is changed.
Well, I always like to remember Alistair McIntyre, who's a very famous philosopher in the United States. What his statement was is, education isn't what you learn, it's what you become. And I think international education is a very important part of becoming.
One of the subjects, which your other subject, apart from criminal law, is law of education. We do have perhaps a credit on that within the Faculty of Education, actually. But could you explain a little bit what is meant by law
and
education?
Absolutely. Yeah. In my course, and at Notre Dame, we don't have a school of education, and so there was no place to locate such a course there. Maybe that's where it would have developed, or maybe we might have had both. I developed the course in the early 70s. What it really intends to deal with is legal issues as they intersect with the campus, either higher education or, as education is divided in the United States, a K-12, from kindergarten through the 12th grade. But when you think about it, virtually every issue arises on campuses, from under our Constitution, from illegal searches and seizures, from religious rights in public schools, religious rights to be funded in private schools, from teacher speech under the First Amendment Free Speech Clause, student speech, all of those things, taxation and support of schools, desegregation racially, equal rights for women in education. All of those things arise on campus and are very important legal issues. And I always like to remember that one of the things that makes the course, I think, so interesting to my students, since I've eliminated myself as a possibility, is that they have been, when they take torts, for example, they're studying whether or not somebody who ran a department store should have had three escalators rather than one, or how often it should have been checked. Well, they've never run a store. But when you, every case you think about that we consider in law of education, they've been in school all their lives. They have a context. They have intuitions. They have judgments as to whether or not, for example, a principal of a school should be able to search their locker, or whether or not a teacher should be able to assign an offensive assignment to somebody, at least offensive from that perspective of that student, religiously or otherwise. So students love the course in that sense. And, of course, I've been in education most of my life, so I have a lot of experience with university committees and bylaws and regulations and red tape and blue tape and white tape and everything else that comes up. So I've immensely enjoyed teaching it.
Yes, so as you say, there isn't one area that can't be touched by legal
issues. Absolutely. I was at a conference once, and I was making that point at dinner with a bunch of lawyers in that area of the law, and I said the only thing that doesn't touch the campus is admiralty. And the lawyer from the University of Florida is always, I get admiralty all the time. So I said, oh, all right, there's that one.
Lovely. What about, you mentioned gender issues and that kind of thing within law and education. We've now actually moved, I think, to a two-thirds female cohort on our law course. What about the United States? More women than men as lawyers,
not
or not?
More, not probably a pretty nice split. At Notre Dame, there's a slightly larger male population in the law school now, and probably, you know, it somewhat due to the fact that Notre Dame until the 70s was an all male institution. So its evolution. And it was it had a large athletic reputation in American football, and therefore I think it still has some aspect of being a male-oriented place. But the undergraduate school is doing very well in that regard. The slight footnote on this, and it's not Notre Dame's problem alone, and it may be true here, is women aren't drawn as strongly to the sciences. For whatever reason, and I'm not going to comment on that since it caused the president of Harvard to be dismissed, but it is true that it's very difficult to get the same level of attention from women in engineering and science and so forth, and that's what affects, I think, Notre Dame's statistics. On the undergraduate level, generally in the United States, curiously what's happening now is that there's about a 60-40 split in favor of women. And the legal issue that is prominent in the United States now is whether or not schools can favor men in attracting them to the program in order to even out those percentages. It's a fascinating legal issue.
Yes, a reversal of roles.
It certainly is a reversal.
Yes, we found, as I say, that we have these large numbers of lawyers graduating every year, many of whom are women. And what we need to do is look into what's happening to them. Where are they going? what type of work are they going into? Are they going into work? So in actual fact, these huge numbers that everyone's terribly worried about may in reality not actually translate then into people in the workforce.
That's an interesting point.
We need to be following. And
inevitably true, I think, at least in the culture of 2010. How much that will change, obviously, we'll have to see.
We also have a system which is slightly different to yours in the sense that our law course is a six-year course, an LLB and an LLD. It's all law from the word go. Your system is go away and do it the first degree in anything, science, history, anthropology, you name it. And then if you want to do law, come to law school. I'd like to know if you think that that is an enriching process for the legal community in general. Is it advantageous to your students? Is it advantageous to you as a lecturer to have people from these very, very, very diverse backgrounds?
Interesting question. Originally, in the United States, law was the first degree. In fact, when I got my law degree, I did get an LLB, even though by that time we had already gone to the 4-3 arrangement that we now have. In about 1980 or something, my university retroactively changed my degree from an LLB to a JD, recognizing that it was not a bachelor's because I already had an AB from my undergraduate work. Why did American education proceed or evolve the way that it did? I think what happened is that when there was a very short legal education following high school, and no four-year college program, coupled with some apprenticeship, of course, in the law offices, that there was a feeling that students needed to be more educated before they became more professional. And what did eventuate, as you're saying, is that we now have students get their first degree. It might be in engineering, might be in some science or history or English. We get everything, and then they get their law degree. The plus is that they come to us, I think, better educated than they otherwise would be. They also, because of the great variety of disciplines, they also are able to enlighten each other and bring to a classroom discussion a panoply of perspectives that you would not otherwise have. The downside is that we only have 3 years to educate them as lawyers. Now, people, you know, don't focus on the fact that if I do a graduate degree in history, I've been doing history courses since I was in the second grade. If I do English, I've been taught English since I was in kindergarten, and so on and so forth. In law, for the most part, none of our students have had a course in law. So we have only 3 years in which to get them legally educated. And so when students worry about a required curriculum, I'm always quick to say that, hey, you know, there are so many basic courses you just have to have that we have to have a considerably required curriculum. And in most American law schools, the first year is a pretty much prescribed curriculum. But that's the way it is developed, and we're on a 4-3 system, and we have a little bit of graduate study beyond JD, but most people do not get an advanced degree in law.
Well, Professor, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very, very much for coming on Research Matters to talk to us today and give the U.S. perspective on your law school.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I do hope you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.